May 14th, 1978, I'm at the Mimsland Hotel to interview Edward D. Freeland, former superintendent of Shenandoah National Park. I'll repeat the date. I hope it's right. It is May 14th, isn't it?
I've been so rushed recently.
Yeah. May 14th, 1978, the Mimsland Hotel. Well, Dixon, what I really need is what you think was important. And if you have something that you've already thought of that you think was most important during your period in charge here, then I'd like to hear about that. And then I could have some questions later.
All right. You realize, of course, that we came here right at the beginning of the war. Mm-hmm. And in fact, we arrived on January the 1st, 1942.
Just about 3 weeks after Pearl Harbor.
Right. And we were here from that time on till October 1950. And during those war years, maintenance and protection was quite difficult because of our lack of personnel. People, lots of people from our organization went into the various military services. And in addition to that, we had to give up a portion of our warehouse because the Smithsonian, because of fear of bombing, came out and used the whole main floor of our warehouse at headquarters.
Did you know what was really there?
Yes.
I've heard so much about this, but no one has ever whispered to me what actually was there. Was it paintings?
Well, there was the first automobile that was ever made was there. The Old Glory, the original Old Glory was there. I believe it's now, I'm not sure whether it's at the Smithsonian or at the Library of Congress, yeah, where it's displayed. I'm not sure about that. But we had to consolidate our warehouse, and an elevator was put in order to take our stuff upstairs. And then they had a full-time guard on the in the warehouse, and the humidity had to be controlled, and we worked out a system whereby that could be done. And they stayed on there all through the war until it was open all over, and then moved back. They had numerous cases of various types. I think there was flower samples, flower specimens, and material that had been collected over a long period of years, archaeological remains.
Oh, yeah. Just totally irreplaceable.
Early man. Big part?
Things that were totally irreplaceable.
That's right.
If they were gone forever.
That's right. That's exactly it.
Yeah.
And then we were helped out. Soon after the war started, we were helped out by a camp of conscientious objectors. Now, all we
CCC had... CCC was all gone?
Oh, yes, CCC. It was completely folded up.
You still had one camp or two camps when you arrived, or
one
maybe
camp.
Four? Two moved out in January, didn't they?
That's right.
Just almost immediately after.
Yeah, well, the boys had all gone. The foreman and the camp superintendents, some of them had left. But there was a small contingent of working foremen, technicians.
ECW.
So to speak. Yeah, right.
Still on ECW.
And it was these people who could not be separated without finding a place for them, if at all possible, because they were political appointees, you see, just as most of them were during that period.
And they were the people that helped them to recondition
the
house.
That's exactly it. They were the ones that I saw no reason why that we couldn't utilize those people to go ahead and recondition the old house so that it could be lived in at least temporary as a superintendent's residence.
Did some of the Smithsonian guards help out a little too?
The Smithsonian
guards? Lynn Black?
Lynn Black was hired as one of the guards.
Uh-huh.
And another was Lester Judd, who lives just east of headquarters there.
One little point, somebody had said that the Smithsonian guards on some of their free time helped also with the superintendent's residence, but...
No.
That's not true.
No, that's not true. No. And then we had the Corps of Engineers came in for winter training, and they didn't have a big group, but they did assemble water lines and all the facilities necessary to keep a water line from freezing. They did some bridge building on some of our fire roads, which helped out a lot, and they did quite a few things on our trails too to help with the work that we were not able to do. We were able to get surplus materials for various projects that we would like to carry out during the war years when it was impossible to get supplies, partly because of the lack of appropriation and partly because they weren't available. We had some very interesting and valuable projects going in schools where we had the few rangers that we had available. We would go around to the mountain schools and the valley schools and make talks on what the Park Service was trying to do and what the park was all about, and especially in connection with fire protection. We had a lot of fires in those days. It was difficult to that character took me off. We tried to get the people around the park boundary, the mountain folks especially, interested in what our aims and ideals were with respect to letting the park or the areas that had been lived in for 200 years restore themselves. You see, they restore the landscape where a lot of shacky buildings had been torn down, and we would eliminate if possible the foundations and then let nature take over by building the trees and shrubs and flowers that would naturally come back if the area was protected.
That's one of the
fire
questions that would be, if I may interrupt just a minute.
Yeah.
Now that you're back, now how long has it been since you were here last?
Well,
since you really went around and looked at the park.
It's only been 5 years I was here.
It wouldn't
five
be so vivid then that you could say what is most noticeable in the way of change here since the time you were superintendent?
The thing that's most noticeable, and I called it to the attention of the superintendent the other evening, the trees in front of his house, between his house and the utility area, were just little scrubby trees, 2 or 3 feet tall, and now they're 15 and 20 feet tall. So it's natural to assume that all over the park, the same thing has occurred with the natural reforestation of areas that had been used by man for 200 years. And a lot of people say, well, that place has been lived in and thoroughly used and misused, and why do you try to make a national park of it? Well, part of our educational program in the schools was to tell people what our plan was, and if they would be patient and wait a few years, they would see how nature would take over and restore the area that had been so thoroughly used.
They seem to understand this today,
the older children understood it, I'm sure, and we also asked them to go home and talk to their parents about it, tell their parents about it, because we wanted to put it over that way. Now, we had meetings with the parents, but it was mostly had to do with fire, but not as much as in the school. The schools is where we did most of our work, and because we had practically no travel at all. So you see, the Rangers, in addition to their patrolling, could go to these schools and make these little talks.
Well, I think you were really attacking one of the central problems that's been with the park from the beginning. The local people tend not to understand very well.
Well, you know, we saw that happen in a number of places. It happened in Teton.
Yeah.
Where there was terrific objection to the National Park Service taking over so much of the land for park purposes. And, you know, now there's no feeling of that sort at all, since they realize what the park has done for the Jackson Hole country in bringing tourists and much, much money into the area, so that those people that felt that we were taking their land away from them, depriving them of a living, they got good money, you know, for their land. And then a lot of them are allowed to live on it anyway and use it for the rest of their life. So you, in a sense, you can have your cake and eat it too. And that's what it amounted to in most cases there. But we had a little different situation here. These people were moved out of the mountains, down to the valley. And in most cases, like down in Ida Valley, a lot of buildings were built, as you know.
Yeah.
And people would move there with a very small rental. And funny thing about it, those mountain folks, and not being used to a bathroom, they'd use the bathtub to store the potatoes or something like that. and we found that was the case in a lot of cases.
They were all, except the lifetime residents, they were all gone when you came.
Out of the park?
Yes, out of the park.
Yes, they were, except...
But there were quite a number of these lifetime...
There was quite a number, yes, but I think that practically all of them are gone now. I haven't really checked. And
they're all out. There's one still alive, that's all.
That's right.
Tiny Shank.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And we had the opportunity and took advantage of it in training our rangers. Now, we had at that time... war time appointments. I mean, these appointments of these rangers, they weren't permanent men. They were given a duration appointment. Uh-huh. And at the end of which they were to take an examination. And if they passed this examination and there was a place for them, they were given a permanent appointment. And of course, we had done it such a good job, at least I thought it was a good job, and it seemed to prove up that was the case, because every single one of our men, and I think there was seven or eight, that took the examination, and every one of them passed, and every one of them was given a permanent job, whether it was in Shenandoah or wherever. Mm-hmm. But they did get a permanent job, so we felt our training definitely was a good thing. After the war was over, we had a period, of course, to get back in gear and get back to our normal public service job of serving our people and our visitors, and it started to pick up right away, and we had a good many little problems that we were able to work out without too much difficulty, because the people that were in the service came back and stepped right in and took over, and we could really get a good start again.
I have a question that may be fitting at this point. You're through with the war years,
yes,
and you're in
yes,
a quick review. I ran across in the Department of Interior report a statement that no other national park dropped so drastically in travel as Shenandoah. Nowhere near. I mean, this park had been over 1 million in at least two
right.
pre-war years.
Right.
And dropped to one full year during the war, something like 45,000.
Yes.
And I was wondering if you had any idea why Shenandoah should be the one park that would drop in travel most drastically of all.
You know, I can't give you any real reason. As you know, there was gas rationing.
I wondered if it was because it was so close to Washington that people felt they were watched more closely in regard to pleasure driving.
It's entirely possible, but you know, recreation driving was certainly not encouraged.
You know, I ran across also a letter from T. McCall Frazier,
yes,
who said that 11 people were actually given tickets on Skyline Drive in 1 week period for pleasure driving. Now, I realized there was rationing and of gasoline and tires, but I didn't realize that it was actually illegal.
I'm not at all aware of that. And
well,
you wrote
back, or somebody drafted a letter for your signature and said that if this is the case, it certainly couldn't have happened in any one day, because
there wasn't that many people
traveling in a day. We had maybe at most 3 or 4 cars.
That's
probably the lowest year of all, maybe 43 would
mm-hmm,
have been.
Mm-hmm. I would think so.
Yeah. Well, I thought you might have something.
No, I don't know.
Hadn't struck me.
I don't know that anyone was. It's certainly news to me if anyone was given a ticket for recreation or pleasure driving.
It struck me as odd.
We very often question them about where they were from and where they were going, and it seems to me that almost every time they were going to some point to on business or for some purpose to visit a sick person, and they were taking the opportunity, even though a little out of their way, to go over the drive to get to where they were going, and I can't say that that isn't correct, but I certainly had no knowledge of anybody given a ticket for pleasure driving. And then you see one of our biggest problems after the war was the racial problem.
Yes.
And the Secretary of the Interior had had issued orders that there'd be no discrimination in our public eating places and campgrounds and so forth, and we attempted to carry it out as faithfully as we could, but what we tried to do was ease into it gradually in order to get our own people in the proper frame of mind so that they would go along with the new policy.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked out very well. We had a little trouble with the concession, but even they, in time, came across very nicely and did just as we had asked them to do. We had a number of unfortunate incidents where the blacks would come into the park and make a reservation and then not keep them.
Just to see if they could.
It was just a test.
Uh-huh.
Yes, just a test to see if they could make a reservation. And that was unfortunate, because it threw out people that would like to stay and couldn't get a reservation because the place really, when after gas rationing was over, it was really surprising how travel picked up.
You feel in regard to race, racial desegregation, that the park was forward, was ahead of the surrounding area of Virginia?
Oh, definitely.
There wasn't any desegregation outside the park at that time?
As far as I know, there was no desegregation, no.
But it was, I guess, going on in Washington.
Oh, definitely.
So that we were more like Washington, really, than we were like the surrounding area.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's right. Well, of course, after after things got started, we enlarged our naturalist service, and at visitor locations like the campgrounds, you know, we had evening campfire programs and slide talks. We had nature walks.
You did get a naturalist. Per se, as distinct from a ranger assigned to naturalist work, along, when was it, 48, I think.
Along in
Ball Favor.
Ball Favor, yes.
He was the first one with the title, actual title,
That's
of
correct.
Naturalist.
And that's correct.
He came, this was inaugurated during your period here.
And then, of course, during the summer months, we had quite a few temporary men, you know, that helped out not only in the ranger force, but in the naturalist force, because one man couldn't handle it alone. There was too many areas to cover, and turn it off. We had very good relations with the State Forest Service. They came in and advised us on various problems we had, especially along the drive where we you see the. The forest returned so fast that the first thing we knew, we were just driving through a green tunnel. And we realized that we had to do some vista clearing. So we not only called in the Virginia Forest Service, but our own landscape people from Richmond, where the regional office was then, came up and we had various meetings and we made a complete survey of the whole drive from Front Royal to Rockfish Gap and outlined on the plans just where the vista clearing should be done. Now, of course, we had objections to that from various sources. They said, you let the trees grow and then you go and cut them. Well, of course, these areas that we cleared were only the areas where there were overlooks. And there wasn't any sense in having an overlook if you couldn't see anything.
No.
So we naturally had to do it. And
well, it antagonized probably some people like Devereaux Butcher. He's just tourist conservationist.
He was one.
The idea of cutting anything, you can't even pick flowers in a national park, much less cut trees.
That's right.
I've had him talk to me about this.
Yes, indeed. He was a firebrand when it comes to things of that nature. We had we had quite a little work done by the conscientious objectors on the Appalachian Trail, and I assume you know that. The Park Service now has the problem of acquiring lands for the Appalachian Trail.
Yes.
Where the trail goes through private properties, either getting the land or getting a right of way for the trail.
I gather that doesn't really affect the park very much, but it kind of impinges into this on. The last 10 miles, Jarman Gap to Rockfish, because the trail is in the park and then out of the park, and they just have this narrow right-of-way.
Yeah. Senator Byrd, of course, was very much interested in the trail, and he had done a lot of hiking on the trails, and I think, if I remember correctly, had furnished the money for a shelter, one of the shelters along the trail. And I think it was named after him. I'm not absolutely sure.
Yeah, Bird's Nest. They call it Bird's Nest.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
And there are four of them now.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
Well, the old senator, I guess, was always a friend of the park.
Oh, yes, definitely.
Granville told me an interesting thing about him. So he always insisted on paying his admission fee.
Yes,
he wouldn't accept admission, which
he wouldn't
apparently
accept.
Normally a senator or a congressman is not charged admission. Is that correct?
Well,
anyway, Granville made quite a point out of Bird's insisting that he pay his fee.
It was a courtesy, you know, that we gave to people that were interested in and did things for us, did things for the park. He did things for other areas as well as Shenandoah.
Uh-huh.
And he was very instrumental in legislation that helped the Park Service. In other areas other than Shenandoah. Now, do you have some questions? I'm just about... I'm just about talked out. If you can... have some questions, it probably will help me to remember. You know, it's been
go ahead and light
it's
up
been
your
a
pipe
number. It's been a number of years.
Like smoking, this yeah, can be it, done in a more
it's
or less
been a
relaxed
number,
way.
It's been a number of years, you know, since I was here and were involved in a lot of other things. You forget.
Oh yes, that's true.
And you know, as you get older, you know, older people they have a tendency to forget too.
I'm afraid I'm just about in that position myself. When I undertook this project, I thought, gee whiz, I'm pretty well familiar with the history of Shenandoah National Park.
Sure.
I lived with it most of the time, and
sure.
I had quite a few bits of work in the park itself.
Yeah.
One of which
yeah.
was
yeah.
when you were superintendent.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've written a guidebook and other
That's
things
right.
about the park, but I found that I really, even things I thought I knew, I just had an inkling, really.
Yeah.
And I found a great deal more in my research on this thing than I actually remembered.
Uh-huh.
It's overwhelming. I think this book, this manuscript is going to be 90% research and only maybe 10%
yeah.
memory.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, you know,
yet I thought I had it
yeah.
in me already.
Well, you're mentioning that guidebook reminds me that during the war years, we had a few men in the conscientious objector camp that helped immensely to put together our first Ranger manual. Now you will perhaps remember that there are a number of small golden books, guidebooks on
mm-hmm.
flowers and various things,
mm-hmm.
and one of the authors is Zim.
Herbert Zim.
Now,
what kind of a fellow was he? Was he showing signs of this type of talent when he was here?
Oh, yeah.
Had he already been engaged in this type of thing?
He was with a newspaper outfit, and he had been a writer. He had been writing various things.
Uh-huh.
And when we found out, you see, we surveyed the whole group to find out if they had any special talents. And he was the one we picked, and he worked out of headquarters all the time he was in the park.
He helped with the Ranger manual.
He did.
He was
yeah.
one of them who did.
He helped with the Ranger manual.
He made certain studies, such as of Lincoln Nicholson Hall.
Yes.
And sort of recommended preservation of, or at least stabilization of some of the old buildings.
Yeah, especially the cabins, the log cabins.
Yeah, and one old mill. I forget which one it was. Maybe it was Lamb's Mill. It was still there down near Swift Run. But anyway, I've seen these studies in the file with Herbert S. Zim on it.
Right.
He must have been quite a remarkable fellow. Was he quite young, do you remember? Or was he a middle-aged man?
I'd say he was about 28 or 30.
Your CPS people weren't all young like the CCC, were they? They had different ages.
No, there were some older ones, but they were mostly... They were mostly from farms, and you know, the church furnished their transportation here. Their parents furnished all the food and clothes. And every weekend, these people would come with truckloads of stuff. You see, all we did is furnish them quarters, the tools to work with, and the supervision. And it didn't cost the government anything other than that, because the feed, the food was all furnished by their parents and the church. And they were Amish and what's the other?
Mennonite?
Mennonite, yes.
Not Quaker.
There might
Quaker
have been
another,
there might have been a
pacifist.
Right.
Mistake,
but there, I believe there were a few Quakers, yes.
Lancaster, was he the superintendent in charge of your work projects? Do you remember?
He was one of them, yes. He was one of them, yes.
Uh-huh. Well, that was an interesting episode. Were they real good workers?
Very good. They didn't...
Better than the CCC workers?
The only time. Yes, they were...
More skilled, I guess.
That's right, more skilled. They were more mature, and they took orders better. Uh-huh. And the only time that we had any difficulty, and it wasn't any real difficulty, the Army came in and wanted some of the surplus CCC barracks in various places where the CC camps were. And we wanted these. They asked if the CC, or if the conscientious objectors would help dismantle these buildings. And that's the only time they refused. They said, no, that would help the war effort. And so they refused. They were very nice about it, they just wouldn't do it. And so we made other arrangements. The Army did it themselves.
Quite a bit of their time, I guess, was taken under some special provision where they could go out and help on the farms when there was some emergency or labor shortage on the farm.
That's correct.
An agricultural program.
Yes, they didn't do much of that, but they did go to the mental institutions and hospitals and help out if they were needed.
So you did lose some of their labor from your part.
A little, yes, but not very much.
Yeah.
Not very much.
Well, I had a number of other questions, and one of them was, if you remember, what the country was like when you first came. It's back to what I introduced a while ago, but do you remember if Big Meadows wasn't perhaps much larger then than it is now, and if there weren't some other open grassy areas when you first came, or had they already disappeared, the open grassy areas?
Like the Vista clearing, we did along the drive. Those open grassy areas, it was decided that some of them we would allow to return, nature to return them to their original state, and other areas would be kept open. Now, Big Meadows was one of the areas, and it was decided to keep it open. And we had some difficulty there. The area was pretty well defined on our plans, so that we had no trouble in keeping it to its original. And when I say original, I mean the area that was used by the mountain folks for pasture or grain or potatoes, corn, whatever they used it for. And it was decided just to keep it open as an open meadow, not to plant it or do anything with it other than to mow it and keep it looking halfway decent. I remember that one spring, the grass and weeds and the little new trees, especially during the war when we couldn't spend the time to do it, it got ahead of us. And when we went in and cut it, there was great objections by certain people because they thought that it should be allowed to return to nature. There was also objections because of the bird life that nested on the ground. And there was other objections too. Other people objected to our cutting the meadow, but it had been decided by all concerned, and I certainly agreed with it, that at least some areas like that, that had been farmed by the mountain people, should be kept open. And I believe there's very few areas other than the areas along the drive that we now keep open for vistas, and the greensward along the drive.
Was it ever considered the type of thing they did in the Smokies and Cades Cove to actually let some mountain-type people graze livestock on some of these open areas as a means of sort of illustrating the life that was there in the past?
You know, there wasn't the opportunities in Shenandoah that afforded that sort of thing like it does on the Blue Ridge Parkway. We didn't have many people living anywhere near the drive. They lived down in the hollows, but they didn't live up on top of the mountain where the road is. And I know it was considered, it was talked about, and the idea was studied, but it never was carried out the way it is down on the Blue Ridge Parkway, and I think that's a wonderful thing down there.
Yeah, it's interesting to the park visitors.
Yes, definitely.
Quite interesting. And I wondered about the emphasis of your interpretive program, if it was entirely on natural sciences, on the flowers and trees, or if some attention was given to the mountain people.
Oh, definitely.
In the interpretation.
Oh, yes, indeed.
But, yeah.
I think that... I don't think we were doing the job then as well as the interpretive people are doing nowadays.
Well, the money was much less, wasn't it?
That's true. But there didn't seem to be quite as much imagination as there is now either. For instance, you know, they're doing all kinds of things like in some of the areas, they have a blacksmith shop in operation. Some of the Civil War areas, they have a little camp set up, and the women will be cooking and making cornbread over the fire, and all sorts of interesting local industries carried on.
Well, I'm glad you said this, because I don't know, not during your term particularly, but it seems to me that all through the life of Shenandoah, there has been a sort of reluctance to take advantage of even such opportunities like this as really sort of presented themselves.
I know.
The only, the PATC at Corbin Cabin, this was saved and reconditioned actually during your period here.
Mm-hmm.
But not, I guess, as a historic building as such, but nevertheless, it's the one thing that has really been taken care of that represents the life of the mountain people.
Well, this new program, you know, is called Living History Program. Mm-hmm. And this Living History Program is being carried out in a lot of areas now. And it's one of the most interesting things that the Park Service has done in a good many years. Now, the one thing that I object to personally in the Civil War areas is dressing up a bunch of people and fighting battles. Now, I think that should be forgotten, and I think it ought to be subdued, and it shouldn't be revived.
Yeah, I sure agree with that.
I think it's a mistake, and I think the Park Service is making a great mistake in dressing up a bunch of people and having these imitation battles between the North and the South.
If this was proposed in Shenandoah, and you know every once in a while there's a movement to emphasize the Civil War history of Shenandoah.
Yeah.
And I think, personally, I think that this is rather ridiculous for several reasons. First, because nothing that happened in Shenandoah was of any great consequence
no.
to the Civil War.
It just passed through.
Jackson passed through.
That's all.
But this was all sort of incidental. It's not major history.
No.
And yet somebody, the Skyline Company did, in cooperation with the park, erect quite a number of fairly large signs about the Civil War involvement
mm-hmm.
with maps
Yeah.
This is interesting. As long as it's interesting to the people, it's probably not hurting anything, but it's not of the essence of the history of Shenandoah National Park.
No.
But I just commenting to see if you...
Yeah.
But no. I think you already had that, you expressed that point of view that,
yeah.
that this is... Well, how about the... do you think that any more should be done or should have been done in Shenandoah in regard to interpreting and maybe preserving remnants of the mountain people? Of course, most of the buildings I know, termites and thyme and leaky roofs, and they're gone.
That's correct. And I think that there were some buildings that should have been saved. Now, there was a brick building at Front Royal. Now, I don't remember the name of it. Don't remember the
Probably either the Simpson
name.
House or the Belmont.
Well, I'm not sure.
It was on Dickey Ridge, I think.
Yes.
I remember it up there, seeing it.
Now, I think that building should have been saved because it could have been restored.
Yeah.
Now, whether it could have been used for anything worthwhile in interpretation or not, I don't know. But it's been so long that I couldn't really comment on it intelligently. But I think then there were some log cabins. And
the ones Zim, perhaps? Perhaps the ones that Zim studied?
Possibly, yes. But I do know that I saw some log cabins that I had hoped we could do something with, but we just couldn't do it during the war. And by the time the war was over, due to the natural deterioration and vandalism, the poor thing just went to pieces.
Yeah, quite a few of them were raised, I think, when you were superintendent.
That's right.
And of course, had to be.
I think they were a little too fast in trying to clean up the areas. And then, of course, you know, there are a good many home graveyards in the park. They probably are pretty well obliterated now.
Some few of them have been taken care of with park permission by the people, but most of them have not. It's true.
Well, we had no objection to the old-timers whose graves were, the survivors of the old-timers, coming in and cleaning up their graveyards if they would like to do that. And we had no objection. All we asked was that they let us know about it so that we could keep track of it. But there are quite a number in the park. I don't know that there's been an inventory of how many graves there are in the park. I could take you to a few, but I don't know where they all are now anymore.
There's been some little study of this matter in very recent years, especially there was a quite thorough study of the Rappahannock County portion in regard to cemeteries.
Is that so?
I'm going to turn this tape over.
Okay.
Well, one thing that I would like to bring up and ask about is in regard to the park boundary. Of course, nothing could be done about it during the war, but I wonder if it worried you much, the very zigzag type boundary with not following geographic features or...
Yeah.
This has been a continuing worry and is right now very top worry, and I just wondered maybe if you had any little background or recollection about anything in this relation.
It was of some concern of ours, that zigzag boundary. It was especially true where it went down far enough where the people could use it, and they would run their cattle on it where they weren't supposed to, and if we said, don't run your cattle on it because it's park property, then they would burn it off. Because after you burned off a section, the next thing that came along, the first thing that sprouted up and produced it all was the huckleberries. And the huckleberries, you perhaps remember, the mountain folks used to make quite a thing of the huckleberries because they would pick them and sell them in the towns or sell them to people along the roads. And of course, after a fire, why, the huckleberries came and We often thought that they started some of these fires just for the purpose. And we weren't so sure that they didn't set the fire just to annoy us because we were confining them to their own property.
Yeah, this was a difficulty. Another type of difficulty on the boundary that is emerging rather strongly now is hiker access. As these people from the city make vacation homes and so on around the boundary, they tend to post no trespassing signs. And some of the trails that have been important park trails, Big Run, Jeremy's Run, Overall Falls, Devil's Stairs, that have access from the boundary as well as from the Appalachian Trail.
Yes.
Some of those are being blocked off with no trespassing signs at the boundary. Was there any beginning of this type of trouble in your time?
No. I know nothing about that now. Yeah. That's all new to me.
Well, really, the boundary wasn't any thing that involved a project or a program of correction in your term.
All we tried to do was keep it marked. That's all we could do.
No effort to buy or sell or trade land.
No.
Of course, the law prohibited buying.
There's no money available anyway.
Yeah. Another little question. Was there radio communication, mobile radio, car to car for the Rangers?
Not till after the war was over.
But after the war it was?
Yes. Then we had good radio communication with every part of the park.
A little more on relations with the Skyline Company, if you have any thoughts on it. Was the Skyline Company helping to promote and helping to understand the park, or were they sort of just acting like a selfish business? I don't mean to make it rough, but to make it plain, were they really cooperating and understanding what the park was about and trying to get this across?
Certain individuals in the company were very understanding and wanted to cooperate. Mr. Lakey was one of those people that was very understanding, and he tried every way to go along with our desires and regulations. The biggest problem we had was, as has been mentioned before, the black. When they started coming in and wanted to go into the dining rooms like everybody else, and he was one of the first to help us with that problem, and was very cooperative. Now, some of his superiors didn't go along with him on that. And that made it difficult for him, because he was in between, you see. And then the other, another thing, when you speak of the concessioner, in their literature, you know, I was trying all the time I was here to get away from Skyline Drive all the time and talk more about Shenandoah National Park. Now, you know, when I came here, I noticed that everybody in the office, when they answered the phone, they'd say Skyline Drive instead of National Park Service or Shenandoah National Park. They'd say Skyline Drive.
You mean the people now, in the company?
Even our own, no, I'm talking about people, our own people in the office.
Oh,
when they answered the phone, they'd say Skyline Drive.
Oh, my goodness gracious.
And we tried to get the company in their literature, instead of having this folder headed Skyline Drive and a little tiny, in little tiny letters, Shenandoah National Park, we asked them to put Shenandoah National Park in the large letters and in the small letters in the Skyline Drive. But you come into the park from Front Royal, and as you go down the street, you'll see right now signs put up by the state or the county, I don't know who, but it says Skyline Drive, and there'll be an arrow. There's no word at all, any place, about Shenandoah National Park.
You know, this has a kind of a natural origin, and this is one of the very strange things about the history of Shenandoah National Park. You know, Skyline Drive existed about 4 years before there was the Shenandoah National Park.
I know.
And yet it was built for Shenandoah National Park.
Yeah.
But it was built, I think, before the Park Service really had any thorough opportunity to study the area.
It was a project.
Yeah, a relief project.
Yes,
and it was sort of foisted on.
Yeah.
And it had this immediate appeal to the people to such an extent that it got famous before the park was really created.
That's correct. And
it's made it a difficulty even to this day.
One thing that's unique about Shenandoah is that the people of Virginia bought the land.
I mean,
they furnished the money to buy the land for the park. I don't know, I can't tell you what percentage of the land the government actually bought. I can't say, I don't know.
Well, almost zero, not quite, but almost.
Yeah, that's what I understand. And it's one of the few places in our country where the people themselves bought the land for the park.
I think Shenandoah is a very unique, I mean, it is a unique park in its history and origins.
Yeah.
Great Smoky resembles it to some extent,
but not
completely.
No.
The Great Smoky got some volunteer contributions and some state funds to help buy also, but the federal government and Rockefeller did most of it.
Yes.
The Great Smoky had some land that had mountain homes on it, and they moved themselves out. Not, it wasn't a resettlement project like here. But Shenandoah, I think, should, I don't know, as I go through all these things, it seems to me sometimes that Shenandoah is not taking full advantage of its own uniqueness.
Yeah.
That this unique thing of being long ago a wilderness, being 2 centuries a heavily exploited area,
right,
and then returning to the wilderness is an event, a sequence, without any real parallel in history.
And you're exactly right.
And yet Shenandoah as a park is not making enough of that in its public presentations to the people.
You know, that's one thing that we tried to put over all the time I was here, that this was a unique experiment in taking over an area so thoroughly used by man and burned and used and farmed, and then let it return to nature.
This is Shenandoah's great uniqueness.
That's right.
It places Shenandoah, if you want to look at it this way, among the crown jewels of the continent.
That's right.
Which nothing else does, because Shenandoah is not a great virgin forest with immense trees, which is what they claimed it was when they first proposed it.
Yeah.
But it is equally important, maybe even more important, because it illustrates the relationship between nature and man in all its variations.
That's correct.
From the beginning wilderness, back to the wilderness again, from farming or grazing or mining or sightseeing, the whole gamut almost of human activities are represented. The mountain residents, the Indians. And I think Shenandoah has a great uniqueness, which should be the central focus. All these other things can go on just the same as they always have.
Sure, sure.
You won't interfere with anybody's recreation, but you would have a real unique reason for existing and a unique mission to fulfill, which I don't think the park feels now that it has.
Well,
it's always second to something.
Well,
we're second to the Smokies in size of mountains or to the size of our trees and the immensity of our real wilderness.
I wonder if we're taking advantage of that important point in our interpretive programs. I wonder if they are. I haven't heard.
Oh, they're moving in that direction.
Well, that's good. I'm glad to hear it, because it is a very important point.
Yeah, yeah. I really believe so. Let's see. I did have some other possible questions, but probably we've
covered most of them. Well, now you made some notes of that.
Well, most of these notes were kind of an index to my tape.
Oh, I see.
So I could find out in what order. If I didn't have time to play the whole tape
at
a particular time, I'd know about where to go to.
Yeah.
But vista cutting is a thing that I think is so crucial. But I think this fits into this pattern. Well, you can't cut vistas in a truly nature park in the minds of the conservationists. And, of course, it's not a historic area. If it's classified as a natural area, you can't cut vistas. If it's classified as a historic area, you're stretching a point, because those
right.
places aren't all that historic.
Yeah.
Even Big
yeah.
Meadow isn't written up in any history books that I know of.
Yeah.
And so, in keeping with what we were talking about a while ago, you need a sort of a man and nature relationship area.
You have to have.
And Big Meadows is ideal for that.
Yeah.
But also these vistas are. And the way that man lives, the way that people live with nature for certain purposes, which is in line with the central mission of how Shenandoah has evolved. And you could have a continuing thing, and you could study the plant succession and so on in these vistas, and take little nature walks as to how in 5 years such and such happens.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of sort of being a little stealthy about this vista clearing, you could even get people to face it directly the way the Park Service is, and to find it interesting
yes.
and fascinating.
You know, another thing that I think in this human history interpretation, you know, there was just lots of stills in the hollows where they made illegal liquor, and you know, we raided quite a few. And
I went on one raid. I got one still.
and you know, I wonder if I don't know what the policy is, but it would seem to me that something like that could be done in the Living History Program. I don't see why not. It's part of the history.
Yeah. There was, you know, was Drew Chick still here when you came?
Yeah, sure.
And he was doing naturalist type work?
He was doing naturalist. Under,
he was a district
under,
ranger
under,
too,
under
I think.
Paul Faber. He was a little both.
Uh-huh. Well, Drew Chick got a still and set it up at Skyland.
Yeah.
But it wasn't operated.
No, no.
It was just sitting there.
That's all.
And operation, of course, in some form would make it living history, otherwise
yeah,
it's
right.
just a museum exhibit.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, it attracted a great deal of visitor attention.
Mm-hmm.
Now, apparently, in recent years, it's vandalized or something. Some
yeah.
parts of it are gone.
Oh, I suppose so.
And, but they could replace that if they had
well,
this
you know,
as part of their policy.
I thought about it a good bit, and then there's no reason why it couldn't be done. You know, you don't have to distill liquor to be a living history.
No, you
program.
Can operate this thing with something
just
else.
Just plain water.
Yeah.
You take the steam off of the hot water and run it through your coils, cool it, condense it, and the thing that drops out in the jug is still plain water, but it starts out from steam, goes through your coil, and comes out as liquor in reality, but in the demonstration, there's no reason at all why, and all parts of it could be labeled. You wouldn't have to even run it with a lot of firewood the way they did it,
no.
you know. You could have a burner under it of some sort, you know, and not necessarily operate it all the time, but for a demonstration.
And again, this relates to the man and nature relationship.
That's right.
And you could even point out maybe the locations of old cornfields,
sure.
or in some cases the surviving trees from apple orchards, because some of what
yeah.
they distilled was apple brandy.
Yeah, that's right.
These people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yet another thing that we didn't cover, it seems to me, as far as I can find in the record, that you inaugurated what was called an open house at Park headquarters and made a great effort to invite people to
we
come.
Did.
And I think this was this the first one, as far as you know, the one you inaugurated?
Well, it's the first one for Shenandoah. Now, whether it had been done in any other park or not, I really couldn't say, but I know we had a very successful program. We worked at it for months to get ready for it. And everybody in the park had a part to play in getting ready for it.
I saw the paper, the Dave News and Courier, had about 2 pages.
That's great.
Articles about the park.
That's right.
And one was by you.
Yeah.
And one was by Granville Lyles.
Okay. Right.
So on. Well, this, I think, you know, I've been one that was a park man
uh-huh.
who yet became perhaps more a completely a citizen of the county than almost any other park person here. I've lived here long enough, consistently enough, so that I get a lot of the gossip, so to speak, from the local scene. And you were working there with what was one of the great essentials of this park. Lots of trouble, not just around the boundary and possible setting of fire or something, but suppose you need something from Congress, which came up during Hoskins' term particularly, an effort to get this boundary line straightened out.
Yes.
Well, there was a great deal of local opposition, and not just from landowners, and it was really unnecessary, except that these people felt that Dan Park was a contrary foreign body in our midst.
Right.
We don't understand them, and they don't understand us, and so they're opposed to what the park wants to get through Congress. And they write their congressman, the 7th District Congressman, and they make all kinds of trouble.
Well, that happens today.
Of course, maybe there's nothing that could be done about it. You certainly did a lot to alleviate and to create understanding.
Right.
But maybe there's not any way to do enough. Because, I don't know, but there's a lot of goodwill for the park. It could be strengthened by working with them more. You know, mostly, I had this idea. I don't know. If you've got just a minute, I'd like to test it out. It seems to me that if there had been some few developments, thinking this thought occurred to me, and I don't know whether it's any good. It doesn't necessarily have to do with our subject, but I don't often get an opportunity to test thoughts out on a man with your understanding. If there could just been a few developments around the boundary, so that, like a trailhead development or a low-level campground, everything is sort of internalized in the park. For example, over on the Stanton or the Rapidan River, the lower places, there could have been a ranger station over there and a ranger there most of the time, and park visitors obviously coming in there and being taken care of and getting on the trail that goes up. That this would have been a rather fundamental thing. A lot of these people have felt that by drawing inside itself and feeding only from the Skyline Drive, that park service is sort of turning its back on the local people. Well, we don't want to have any more to do with you than we have to.
I think you have an awfully good point, and you know, that would be a wonderful public relations, especially local public relations program, to have these little stations, even though manned only part-time, at these trailheads, important trailheads. Mm-hmm. Because a sign doesn't do the job that an individual does. And you've got a good point. Have you ever talked to the superintendent about it?
No, I haven't. I just really got this idea in the last stages of my work here.
I think you ought to talk to him.
But I will.
Of course, you realize that it takes money to provide the facility and the physical facility and the individual to operate it. But you know, we have in the parks now what they call volunteers, VIP, volunteers in parks. Now, you know, that would be a wonderful opportunity. All of the parks have young people now. The schools, you know, a lot of colleges are putting on training programs for park people. And I know that where my son-in-law is superintendent down at Pinnacles National Monument in California, he has volunteers that come in there. They're in the program at their college, and they spend the weekend in the park working. They wear the park service uniform at their own expense, and yet they come and work in the park. And of course, their work is part of their training, and they get credit for it. And yet they're doing us a lot of good because they're doing a job that we don't have the personnel to do.
Yeah, they had quite a few VIPs here in the last year, and probably will have in this
season. That's fine, but now some of those people could could operate those trailhead stations.
PATC would volunteer to help with that. I mean, they'd furnish some
VIPs, right?
Some volunteers.
Good.
They've always indicated that they were willing to do something like that, and they volunteered to help patrol. You know, they have this new backcountry program in which you can go anywhere, camp overnight, that is almost anywhere, with certain regulations. You get a permit.
Yeah.
Well, the PATC would furnish volunteers to help patrol that thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's good. I appreciate your comments on that. And another one that I think hasn't been given enough attention in recent years is this, that they charge a fee. They charge a fee for admission to Shenandoah. The fee has gone up in recent years till it's $2 per car. Blue Ridge Parkway does not charge a fee. Great Smoky Mountains does not charge a fee. And if people were being equally treated, I mean the local people feel this. Many of the local people that would like to go up in the park are mad at the park because they have to pay this damn fee. Was that true in your time? Did you get any static or?
You know, we didn't have any fee at all.
Not during the war.
During the war. And it wasn't until after the war that we did start having a fee, and I think it was $1 then. But you know, I tried something in Teton. I got in the doghouse over it, but I felt that it was important from a public relations standpoint with our local people. We had each county in Wyoming has a number. And Teton County, if I remember correctly, was 22. And I just passed the word around that anybody with a number 22 license would be admitted free to the park. Well, of course, there was nothing official about it. It was just something that I was doing under the heading of public relations in order to get the people of our county who were the main objectors to the park and its enlargement to feel a little better about it. And it helped a lot. I think it was more than the small amount we would have collected, worth more than the small amount we would have collected with
the fee. Well, this strikes me as a matter of accumulating significance here. The people have said to me, well, I gave $50 to buy that land to give to the government.
Yeah.
And then I want to go up there and they charge me $2. And I don't really think it's right, especially when they don't charge anybody on the Blue Ridge Parkway, they don't charge anybody in the Smokies, and they say, if every area was doing this, then I might be able to be content with it. But I gave money to buy that land. It was presented to the government without cost.
Yeah.
And yet they're soaking this to get in, and it's just us. They're not soaking other people in the East. I don't know about Acadia, whether there's a charge for admission to Acadia, but possibly not. I doubt if there is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? Well, yeah. Unless anything further has occurred to you, I will.
Well, I'll tell you. I'll look over my notes when I get home. And if I have anything there that we haven't covered, I promise I'll drop you a note. I'll drop you a line.
I really greatly appreciate the privilege of talking with you about this because, as I say, I feel a little lonely sometimes because I'm working with things that, that no one else knows about or can connect up with.
Sure, sure.
Yeah?